Experts figure there are nearly 7,000 different languages on this planet. But every month, that number gets a little smaller. Russ Reimer's been investigating just what the world loses as minority languages become endangered and eventually disappear. He's contributed to the Vanishing Voices series at National Geographic, and the Overseas Press Club selected his writing on this topic as the best magazine reporting from abroad in 2013. Russ, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
Now, you studied a little language in Siberia, one in India, and one in Mexico. Tell us why you took this on, and basically, what's the state of big languages and little languages on this planet now?
Languages have long fascinated me, and I've written about them previously for The New Yorker. And so National Geographic called me when they were wanting to do a story about the plight of endangered languages, of which there are very many. There are 7,000 languages in the world. Among, 7 billion people, that sounds like everybody would have a fair share of speakers. But in fact, the largest several languages dominate, and there are a whole slew of languages that have just a handful of speakers, maybe several thousand, maybe only a dozen, maybe only one.
Wow.
We were interested in finding some languages among those enormous variety of languages that are endangered that would demonstrate the plight of these languages worldwide.
Now, why does it matter? I mean, the gist of your article is these are precious and they need to be respected. Mm-hmm. It seems to me it'd be more efficient if all these little languages just chucked it in and just spoke English. It's on the computer. It's efficient.
And that's a widely held opinion. I talk to people who say, well, it's a problem that we have this enormous variety of languages. If everybody spoke the same language, then everybody would be on a level playing field and technology would be so much easier and learning would be easier to format. It would be a much more efficient world. The other opinion is that there is a tremendous value hidden inside these individual languages. The diversity of languages is somewhat akin to biodiversity. And we're used to the concept that biodiversity hides many hidden treasures. We're used to the idea that there may be a tree in the Amazon that's undiscovered, but once discovered may offer enormous medicinal qualities, for instance. Hmm. Languages are analogous. And as linguists uncover more of these languages, because they are by no means all discovered, and as they actually work to ferret out their secrets, they're providing lots of valuable information on several levels. Okay. One of those levels is just cultural. It tells us a lot about the variety of cultures in the world and what's arbitrary and what's universal among all of the world's cultures.
And then what did you learn? You were in Siberia, India, and Mexico. Did your study bear that out? What's an example of how the presence of these small languages enriches us from a cultural point of view?
Well, to pick an example, when I was in Kyzyl, which is the capital city of Tuva, which is a Russian republic, down on the Mongolian border near Kyrgyzstan, it's a discrete state, but it's very removed. And its language is remarkable for staging something of a comeback now. It's off an endangered list and doing fairly well. But the things that are natural in Tuvan life that are expressed in their language, I found remarkable. For instance, Tuvans never speak of the future being ahead of them. They see the future as being behind them. They would never say, I'm looking forward to the day after tomorrow. They would say, I'm looking forward to yesterday. And this seems to be very strange to our Western ears, but our way of thinking sounds strange to them. They reason that if the future were ahead of you, you could see it, it would be in plain view. But the past is what's in plain view, so that must be what's ahead of you.
Yeah.
This is just a small linguistic concept, but it changed my appreciation of the way I go through the world, changed my appreciation of English.
I guess you can pick up from other languages, they have more focus on different dimensions of life than we would have. I remember reading in your article, you talked about, I believe in Tuvan, there's 50 different words for family relations, much more than what we would have.
In the language of the Seri, another group that I studied and visited on the coast of Mexico, that's also true. They have a tremendous concentration on the way family members relate to each other. So, for instance, in Seri, a woman would have a different word for father than a man would. The relationship is very different between women and men to their parents and expressed in different vocabulary.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Russ Reimer, and we're talking about vanishing voices and dying languages. Russ has written an article for National Geographic magazine called Vanishing Voices, and it's amazing to think that there's 7,000 languages on this planet, but half of those languages are spoken by only 8 million people. There's a lot of small languages, and they can be small and vibrant, and we can learn from these languages different ways to appreciate different dimensions of cultures. Do some languages have number systems that predate the 10-base number system that we just think is standard?
This is an area where the cultural diversity of the world becomes evident. Some languages, indeed, don't use a 10-base system. Some languages don't even have numbers. They will only refer to less and more or to general quantities.
Wow.
Others may have an even more elaborate set of systems than our 10-base system. But a number is not the only thing that we just take for granted that languages demonstrate the diversity of. Color is another tremendous variable within languages. And languages don't always have the same number of colors. The Akha language did not have a word for yellow, even though yellow was a prized color in jewelry. The yellow beads of the Taja necklace was very prized. But if you asked them what color it was, they would answer with the same word they used for red. And that's not so uncommon. The way we separate colors visually that we think is very much set in stone varies from language to language quite a bit.
I suppose it's ethnocentric just to think that why shouldn't people just use the same language so we don't have to have multilingual signs and so on. These are beautiful cultures that are not basing happiness and success and fulfillment on our values necessarily. And they have languages that fit their cultures that have evolved for thousands of years.
Absolutely. The Seri, or Konkayak is their other word for themselves. It's a tribe that is based in the Sonoran Desert right on the edge of the Gulf of California in that northwest section of Mexico. It's very remote, and because they've had an antagonistic relationship for hundreds of years with the majority Spanish culture, it's very culturally removed also. Mm-hmm. But their language reflects some of what you're talking about also. They, for instance, being nomadic, see possessions as a burden. Your possessions are the things you have to carry. So they see wealth as a problem, and wealth that's not shared, they see as a sin. So they have a phrase. They had some just lovely phrases, but one of them was that the day the Seri become rich, they will cease to exist.
Wow, wealth not, I'm writing that down. Wealth not shared is a sin. And that would be embedded in their way of thinking, and it's just how the kids learn their language.
When a Seri tribesman dies traditionally, they would be buried with everything that they own, which would amount to a few bowls. So actually, language was the only inherited object in a Seri family. Stories and tales, the verbal legacy, was the only inheritance.
This is like a whole new light on cultural diversity. Russ, we're talking about these small languages. Is there a level at which a language is not sustainable and becomes terminally ill? Does it have to have a written language? Does it have to have media or a newspaper or a university? Or how do you measure the health of a language and predict its future?
Well, of course, not having a newspaper and a TV station and a currency means you're at the mercy of the languages that do have those things, because they are going to be the languages where commerce is done in the world and the languages that have to be spoken if you want to trade.
So a small language that doesn't have a media and a newspaper and university, it may be healthy, but it'll be apart from the modern world and, in a Western sense, losing out on all the modern prosperity.
And to that degree, speakers of small languages have to also speak a larger language if they want to engage with the larger world.
Well, now that kind of takes us to Europe, because I know in the last generation, the small languages of Europe have made a remarkable comeback.
Mm-hmm.
But I think most of those people also speak German or Spanish or English to have an outreach to the rest of the world.
True. Many languages like the Tuvan language are making comebacks. The mystery that you're alluding to in your question before is that a neighboring language may not be doing as well as the language that's making a comeback. So one language can be building back up from near oblivion to several thousand or 100,000 speakers, while the language next door is dwindling down to a dozen and then to two and then to none. And the difference that people I talked to kept mentioning was pride. It's not something that can happen from the outside. A language is not easily buttressed from the outside. But the one aspect that keeps a language strong and will allow it to revive is the pride of the native speakers. So naturally, parents are telling their children, no, you need to speak Hindi. You need to speak English because I want you to have a good education. I want you to have a fortune, you know, good fortunes in the world to break out of this little village. Mm-hmm. And yet in the little village in India where I visited, I remember the day that these two teenagers showed up. This is an area of India, Rick, that is especially remote because it's contested border territory between China and India. So even other Indians can't cross into Arunachal Pradesh without federal permission. National Geographic had to work to get permission for us to even go into this mountain region. The villagers in Paliji, this little village that I was staying in, had never seen a dollar bill. The American culture was that foreign to them. And yet, these teenagers showed up one day to said, we want to present something to you, meaning the linguists that I was traveling with. And they sang a pitch-perfect South Central Los Angeles rap song with all the hand gestures, with all the, you know, the bobbing neck, looked like gang signs. They had the whole thing down. And where they got it, I don't know. I was dismayed because I thought, well, you know, God, look what the first thing they picked up from American culture is this. But the linguists were delighted, and I said, why? And they said, because they could have done that rap song in Hindi, they could have done that rap song in English, but they chose to do it in Akha.
And
when
pride.
The teenagers in a community are choosing their native language to do their expression, that's a sign of the kind of pride that will let a language persist.
Beautiful. That's promising. Journalist and author Russ Reimer is our guest right now on Travel with Rick Steves. His latest book is a mystery called Paris Twilight. And he's written for the National Geographic series on vanishing languages and enduring voices. His website is russreimer.com. That's R-Y-M-E-R. You can hear samples of Tuvan and other endangered languages in the National Geographic's Talking Dictionary project. There's a link in this week's show details in the radio section of ricksteves.com. Russ, when a language dies, is there an attempt to preserve it, and how does that work? Because they die. How often? I mean, what did you say? Every few days a language dies?
Every few days a language dies. Within the century, linguists expect half of the world's languages to disappear.
Half. So are we working to preserve these? 100 years from now, will anybody even know what it sounds like if we don't do something right now?
The languages are being recorded by linguists. Of course, with the great number of languages and their obscurity, and also the difficulty of locating them in these very distant outposts in the world, as many of them are, that's quite a challenge. And many languages will die without being recorded. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the more daunting thing is that you can't record everything about it. Mm-hmm. The language itself is part of a larger practice. And the connection between language and practice is really a tremendous concern. I met a young man named Pariah Nimisau in the Himalayas. He was a speaker of Akha and taught actually at the Jesuit school because he was also fluent in English and Hindi. And he pulled out over dinner one night, a very traditional dinner in the center of this dark hut with the fire going in the middle of the hut and the smoke going up through the roof. He pulled out a little cloth sachet that held a number of exotic items. It held the jaw of a river pike. It held a serpent's jaw. It had a crystal there. There was a tiger's tooth. And so he told me that this was his father's shaman's sachet, that this was a sachet of things that his father could use to work spells that would cure people. And his grandfather had had the sachet before his father. And I asked him, so are you the next shaman? Are you inheriting this kit and the knowledge to put it to work? And he said, no, his father had died before he had imparted the spells. And although he had the items, he did not have the words. And without the words, the sachet was useless. So there's a tremendous conjunction between practice of a culture and the language that goes with it. And it's very daunting and almost impossible to really preserve that, even if you can get in dictionary form or in recording form, the language itself.
That right there sums up the value of these small languages and the tragedy when the sadness, when one dies and our planet becomes a little less culturally diverse.
Mm-hmm. These small languages offer us information about our world that we consider important, and that is back to biodiversity. Small languages contain much more information about nature than large languages do. because the speakers are very often much closer to nature and rely on it at a much more survival level. And so they are close observers, and they enshrine what they observe in their vocabulary.
So a scientist can learn about nature by just studying a language of a culture that's closer to nature than we are?
That's true. And the Seri, for instance, on the coast of the Gulf of California, have provided science with numerous revelations about how the biological world works and how different species act that we would not have gotten without their help. So when we think of these languages primitive, we're learning a very high-level scientific information from these languages. For instance, the Seri have a word for a turtle that the word contains the information that this is the turtle that goes to the bottom of the sea to hibernate. It was a behavior that the scientists thought was outlandish. They had not heard of a turtle acting like this, but the word was there, and so they investigated and found out, yes, actually, this species of turtle hibernates in the sand at the bottom of the ocean. And
that's
great. So here's an example of biological behavior and peer-reviewed scientific papers in Science and Nature really reflecting the knowledge of these nomadic tribesmen.
Wow. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been exploring the concept of vanishing voices and dying languages with Russ Reimer. And Russ has written an article for National Geographic magazine called Vanishing Voices. Russ, I'd like to close with just a comment from you. In your article, you wrote, "The tongues least spoken still have much to say."
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that I certainly came away from my travels to, you know, the Indian Himalayas, to Siberia, to the coast of Mexico. I came away from those travels feeling that my introduction there by people that spoke these different languages to their languages and to their way of thought told me things that I could never have suspected, introduced me to worldviews that I found novel and enlightening. I feel that I was changed in my perspectives permanently by having the privilege of talking to these people and having them open up and talk to me about their language. I think that what I experienced on an emotional level is true on a more factual, cultural level in the world, and that there is a value across the board ranging from just hardcore scientific information on one side to the deepest insights into the way our cultures work and what the variety of human experience is that would be lost as these languages die, and that the efforts of some linguists, but mostly of the native speakers themselves, to honor their languages and to keep them alive is preserving an international treasure.
Maybe these small languages enable us to hold a mirror up against our culture and see that while we're wealthy in a lot of ways, in some cases, maybe we can learn from their less material wealth and their connection with each other and culture and nature.
I would agree.
Russ Reimer, thanks so much for your work, and it's been fascinating to think about all those little languages struggling and thriving and adding to cultures on this fascinating planet of ours. Best wishes.
Great. Thank you, Rick.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton with Sarah McCormick and Isaac Kaplan-Wilner. Thanks to the Radio Foundation in New York, the studio in Portland, Maine, and Colorado Public Radio for their help this week. You'll find more in the radio section of ricksteves.com, and we'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Travel with Rick Steves is made possible in part by the European Union delegation to the USA. The European Union received the 2012 Nobel Peace Prize for promoting peace, human rights, and democracy. Information available at euintheus.org.